Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us. My name is Jeff Beckwith. I am the Executive Director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association and also the host or the moderator of the weekly COVID-19 briefings that the Lieutenant Governor and the Baker Plato administration are providing to all of the municipal chief executive officers in Massachusetts. This is our eighth of these sessions. And during this crisis, and these sessions are providing extraordinarily important information to all of you as you lead your cities and your towns through an unprecedented emergency. Today's agenda will start with the Lieutenant Governor, who will provide an overview and an update on the reopening process. She's in charge of that process for the administration. And then we'll hear from the Deputy Secretary for Housing and Economic Development, who will provide us an update on some important funding programs and business support programs. And then we will have available officials from MEMA, from DPH and the Division of Local Services, who can provide updates and answer questions. Right now, it's my pleasure to introduce to you the Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth, Karen Pulido, who has been providing extraordinary leadership and communication to all of you during this process. Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for participating on the eighth one of these sessions and many others in between the times that we get together on Tuesday afternoons. I know you'll be hearing from Tim McGurthy and Dr. Madoff, as well as Director Phillips and Sean Cronin as part of this call. And then, of course, your questions and answers and feedback is really important. I also wanted to note that we were with leadership yesterday and talked about the legislation that is coming through the House and the Senate to help you reorganize your ability to conduct business through your town meetings. And I know that is something of high importance to all of you. And we certainly will sign that as soon as it reaches our desks. You're also very interested in hearing about the COVID Relief Fund and how that resource will be made available to you. And I believe ANF with Sean Cronin will be on a call on Thursday to address those issues. And tomorrow, the MMA and their partner group, MAPC, will be presenting to the reopening board relative to your thoughts and analysis around safely reopening more activity within your communities. We do this in partnership with you, and it was a topic that we discussed last week when we were on this call about how to do that together. Let me just start with the reopening advisory board. It's a great group of stakeholders, including the three municipal representatives, Mayor LaChapelle, Mayor Rivera, and Catherine Burton from Mayor Walsh's office. And we have now met with 44 different industry associations and community coalitions that represents over 110,000 businesses and more than 2 million workers, to get a flavor of how businesses and industries are planning for safely reopening their workplaces, being mindful that that means a plan for their workforce, as well as a plan for the people that they do business with and the public-facing nature of their organization, should that also be part of their business model. The reopening plan will take place in a four-phase process. You heard the governor speak to this yesterday at our press event, and it is similar to what you're seeing in other places around the country or in our region. Our first phase starts with start. You know, we've got to start this process. It will then move into a more cautious phase where we can introduce more industries as the public metrics allow us to. Phase three is a vigilant stage where we will loosen even more restrictions depending on the nature of the enterprise. And it probably in phase two and three would include more public facing opportunities at that time. And then, of course, phase four will be not a return to normal, but a new normal. It's just a new way that we will all be either conducting business, engaging socially, and participating in activities in the future. So that the workplaces we need to make safer, and that's where the mandatory safety standards come into place for workplaces. This is an area which required a lot of great thinking through the advisory board and the interactions that we've had with industries to talk to us about how businesses are approaching what a COVID safer workplace looks like. And they include things that you're very familiar with, you know, and you've got to think about these things in your workplace as municipals entering into a phase where you will be conducting more business in person and less business remotely. And these standards apply to everyone, applies to state government, applies to municipal government, and applies to all businesses. The social distancing piece of the mandatory safety standard it talks about the being employees, customers, and vendors should remain at least 6 feet apart to the greatest extent possible, both inside and outside of the workplace. We put it to the greatest extent possible because there are points of time when you might find yourself in a hallway or a stairwell or an elevator, and you may say, how are we always going to be 6 feet apart? So we're mindful of that, but we also will have industry-specific protocols that will guide an industry or an employer in an industry about the how-to. And we've heard a lot from all of you about be specific. If you're going to tell us to do something, please also give us some guidance around how to do this. So the social distancing is an example of how does an employer comply with 6 feet when, given the nature of their business, it might be hard to do so all the time. And providing guidance that these are the things that you can do in order to comply with the standard. So the social distancing piece is really important, and providing signage in the workplaces around that. We already issued the face covering and mask requirement, and that will be required for all employees as well as they conduct the work associated with their job. Hygiene is the second bucket, you know, talking about hand washing capabilities in a workplace, the frequency of washing and adequate supplies to do so, regular sanitization for high touch areas. The third bucket is staffing and operations to be able to train your employees about what social distancing and hygiene protocols are. What does that mean for your workplace? And if an employee is displaying symptoms, that they need to know not to come to work, and that there is a plan for employees if they do get ill from COVID-19 at work. How are you going to address their time to recover and their eventual return to work? And then the final bucket is cleaning and disinfecting and making sure that there is a plan in place for this. So what we announced yesterday was the standard, that this is the mandatory, this is the requirement. You will be seeing industry-specific guidance and that will also be available. I want to make note that we also are going to be providing checklists and a template. So a workplace, an employer can say, okay, I know what these standards are, I'm reading this guidance, but boy, I want to get this done as quickly as possible. So we are going to provide you as an employer with a template, and that template will be, in essence, your safety plan. And this is most likely going to be a self-compliance process, where I have my checklist, I have my template, and I'm gonna go make sure that I have all of these things in my workplace before I can safely reopen. And that then the state authority and local boards of health will have the authority if someone calls and complains. It could be a customer, it could be a worker, and they call and complain, then your local board of health will have the authority to go visit that workplace and ask for the safety plan and to see that the checklist and the safety plan are available. So you will have that level of specificity available to you when we roll out the plan, which will be announced on Monday, and the industry sectors that we will release on Monday that will be allowed to reopen. So more to come on what industries specifically will be included in that phase one. I do want to note that there is also a grouping of businesses that are currently operating. These were the ones that were initially green-lighted as essential businesses. You've already had a fair amount of interaction with a lot of these businesses, especially your groceries. They will be extended for a period of time so that they also will need to comply with the workplace safety standards and will have access to the industry specific guidance and checklists and templates. And they will have probably about a week to be able to comply with that as well. So that gives you a sense of where we're heading. That's obviously very complex. And all of this is prefaced with the specific guidance, or I could say more of a directive from Health Department, the Department of Public Health, and the COVID Command Center, that in essence, it is the right time in Massachusetts to begin to reopen under a phased approach. So we will have to look at the trends that we're seeing. We're hoping that they continue to trend downward this week so that that can occur. But if there was a spike, if there was an outbreak, if something odd occurred between now and Monday, we would need to adjust the reopening phase of this plan. We will be able to provide a way of interacting with you over the course of this week, maybe later in the week, to make sure that you are informed, that you have as much notice and access to the materials that you'll need to be able to be ready when we say literally let's go on some things. Testing continues to be a really important part of this plan as well. You know, we talk about the facial coverings, we talk about safe distancing, safer workplaces. Testing will continue to be a part of that toolbox and the tools that we'll use to test, see where spread is, and be able to continue to use quarantine and isolation as ways to control spread. We are a state with a very high capacity to test, and we will be releasing fairly soon an expansion of our testing abilities, which would include random serology testing, much like you're seeing at the MGH and what they're talking about, and ramping up our per day testing for symptomatic and close contact individuals, and being able to turn around test results in a faster, more streamlined and efficient way to inform the partners in health folks, as well as our Department of Public Health, about what this virus looks like in the upcoming months as we continue to add more activity to the communities of our Commonwealth. Contact tracing, you are aware that we have over 1,600 of these individuals working with partners in health and the local boards of health to basically get in contact with those individuals who have come in contact with a COVID positive person and have an interview and a conversation with them around how to safely quarantine and reduce the spread. I would just like to pause there. I'm sure that there are some questions that are coming up in the chat. We can do that now, or we can hear from Dr. Madoff, who I know has to leave at 1:30, and come back to some of these specific issues. So why don't we do that so that you can hear from the public health folks and see if there are any issues that are raised in this chat that Dr. Madoff can address, and then I will stay on and be able to have more conversation with all of you.
Thank you very much. That's a good segue. We can ask Dr. Madoff if he has any supplemental comments regarding the report from or update from DPH. As I identify some of the public health questions, Dr. Madoff has a hard stop at 1:30. So that's excellent that we're moving there now.
Thank you, Jeff, and thank you, Lieutenant Governor. You covered the major DPH topics very well, and I appreciate it. And we're really hopeful on the current state of COVID in Massachusetts, that things continue to improve, and that our social distancing and other public health measures have begun to show a benefit, and hospitalizations are down, case numbers are down, our rate of positive testing, the number of positive tests per test performed is down, and as Lieutenant Governor indicated, we really are leading the country in testing. One of the things that we've started to roll out this week is the ability to test contacts of known cases, and that's going to be part of the contact tracing coalition's guidance to contacts, is that these asymptomatic contacts get tested early in their contact period, so that we can know sooner if some of those individuals turn positive and can take appropriate actions and really try to limit the spread. And I think as we move into some of the relaxation of social distancing, the contact tracing, our ability to really know about all of the cases through testing, and our ability to rapidly and accurately track them and isolate and quarantine cases and their contacts, becomes a mechanism to contain the outbreak, even as our social distancing begins to relax a little bit in phase one. Jeff, I'll turn it back to you if you have specific questions that I can answer at this point.
Right. There are a couple of questions that that might be helpful as communities are looking ahead, even if it's not in phase one or in phase two. Given the structure of municipal buildings with corridors that are less than 6 feet in width, workstations that are closer together, and the 6 feet social distancing might be very, very challenging. Do you envision a requirement of everyone inside wearing masks, just because that can't be maintained? And how would communities work, or would you recommend that they work with residents or visitors who decline to wear face coverings when they enter these public buildings?
Well, our hope is that people will continue to wear face coverings for precisely the reason that the questioner is raising, because it's not always possible to maintain the 6 feet distance. And that's why the governor's order asks every individual to wear a face mask when they can, and when they don't think that this social distance can be adequately maintained. And so my feeling, at least, is that needs to apply in every situation, and in every public-facing situation, certainly. We recognize that it's not always possible in every situation, and that's why the masking requirement is there. These industry specific guidances are pretty demanding to roll out, as you can imagine, because there are so many different possible situations we try to stick to our guidance as to what is best from a public health measure, and then try to figure out how those can be implemented in each specific situation. We're not there yet, just to say that. There's this guidance is yet to come, and even the phases as they roll out are yet to come, but we're aiming towards them. It's a goal.
And Dr. Madoff, I just also underscore that there are a number of questions that have come in just regarding, for example, town meetings and town elections, where the safe practices themselves and social distancing will be critically important because of the concerns over spread. At the same time, I think it's likely that legal questions will be raised about whether communities can require face coverings, for example, when people are exercising their legal right to vote or participate in a town meeting. And so it's probably more than just a public health question. There are also legal questions about the extent to which communities can require these in certain public settings that adds further complication for local governments.
We certainly understand that. And there's a lot that's still in progress, and we know that there are legal and ethical questions that haven't been fully answered yet, but it's something that we are all gonna have to grapple with as we move forward.
We'd encourage you then, as you're coming up with the specific situations, if it's possible to collaborate with the executive branch legal office to be able to put in place and share at the same time the parameters of what municipal authority is. That would be very helpful in terms of providing what would be robust guidance, as opposed to then having communities have to trace a parallel track.
I think I'll certainly convey that to our team. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm scrolling to see if there are other DPH questions. Here's one. On Friday, the MMA provided links to our members for the updated return to work guidelines, and communities were looking at that, and they're just a desire for more clarification. For example, one page says employers should not require a COVID-19 test result or a healthcare provider's note for employees who are sick in order to validate their illness or qualify for sick leave or return to work. And that doesn't seem to match up with other guidance that's been released in the past or under the federal Families First legislation. So just wondering if there's a possibility of getting clarification.
I'm not familiar with that particular legislation. This guidance was issued in conjunction with DPH and the command center, the COVID command center that is part of the administration team, and it is our hope that in sort of the smooth functioning of our society that written documents documenting somebody's status and their COVID testing shouldn't be required, that this is something that we would try to avoid just in trying to keep our all of our operations running smoothly. This is something that just hampers that. And so it's our hope that we can try to avoid requiring a doctor's note. As healthcare professionals are stretched very thin, visits are virtual. And for many of these reasons, it's better if we try to avoid the requirements for documentation on return to work.
Okay, thank you. And Doctor, two final questions for you. One is that question about the ability or the efficaciousness, I guess, of taking temperatures for employees or visitors in to assess symptoms. And then also a question about testing and whether or not close contacts are tested if they are not yet showing symptoms.
Right, so that last question first. Yes, our goal is to test close contacts of symptomatic individuals, even if they're not showing symptoms. I know that this is a change, and this is a forward-looking idea that we really want to try to get ahead of this virus, and this is one way of doing so. So our guidance, we are planning to issue new guidance on testing that will specifically address this point, and for the as we have done, for example, in our congregate settings, looking for staff and residents of congregate settings who were tested while asymptomatic, we would also look to test these contacts who are asymptomatic and we want to roll out guidance so that providers and testing centers will accept this new guidance and actually test these individuals. We know that this is quick, moving quickly, and it's a challenge to get everybody on board at the same time, but we have to start somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And then on temperatures?
On temperatures. This is one measure that's been adopted in various places, and different institutions have done it differently. Temperature checks are one thing that can be done. I think the strategy with employers should be first that people who are symptomatic and sick should be asked not to come to work, and I think that's probably the most important guidance that we can offer. Secondly, when people come to work, if you can screen them for their symptoms, just kind of remind them at the point of entry, if you're feeling sick, even if it's mild sickness, you should stay away for the safety of everyone else in the workplace. And finally, temperature checks are something that some places have instituted and others have not. So some of our healthcare institutions are using temperature checks, some aren't. I think they, my personal opinion is they don't add a lot to asking people whether they're sick or not. I think many people who are becoming sick don't have a temperature, don't have at the time that they're entering and could develop one at any time. People take antipyretics like Tylenol to then lowers their temperature, and that can give people kind of a false sense of security. I think if people are asked about their temperature and check their temperature themselves, that's also a very good measure. And finally, just the actual process of taking the temperature is time consuming, requires personnel. And if you don't have a non-contact thermometer, which are somewhat expensive and hard to come by, it involves, you know, being very careful about cleaning and disinfecting the thermometer between each use. So my thought is that temperature checks have a limited utility, but this is something that we're going to have to look at more carefully and see how we can institute it maybe on an industry-specific or location-specific manner.
Well, thank you, Doctor. With 40 seconds left, I think we gave you a little bit of time. We have noticed that there are some, instead of the general question of, are you sick, we've heard that it's helpful to actually provide like a list of the 12 symptoms.
Yes.
And
absolutely,
then people do a better job of self-diagnosing.
Yeah, and some, you know, our healthcare institutions have been very proactive with this and actually using apps, for example, to list it so that each employee attests each day about each of the possible symptoms as a way of screening. Certainly written checklists are useful, and we will be issuing more specific guidance on this point.
Great. That might be more helpful than the temperature.
So thank you. And my apologies for having to leave early. And my thanks to all of you for being here and listening.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your contribution. Thank you. Lieutenant Governor, now we can move on with the remainder of the briefing. I do know that we're fortunate to have the Deputy Secretary of Housing and Economic Development here. We want to make sure that he has some time during this briefing to provide the update from regarding the funding that has been provided by the federal government and the process.
Before we go to the Deputy Secretary, I did see in the chat a couple of areas I'd like to just cover, and then we'll transition over to Tim McGurthy.
Perfect.
One was regarding restaurants. We love our local restaurant business owners, but I do know that tomorrow MMA is presenting, as well as MAPC, around a Main Street reopening plan, as well as thinking about restaurants. Restaurants have unique features, as everyone knows, and we will need to work closely with municipalities to make sure that whatever inspection or re-inspection or best practices that you need to understand as you look at how restaurants can bring more activity, both outdoor and indoor, their establishment is important. We will need to work with municipalities around the industry protocol and how a safe reopening can happen and streamline that so that we don't further delay when there is a point in time that they safely can reopen, but that we have a coordinated, streamlined approach to doing so. I do also recognize a question around these industry protocols. We will need to work with you to disseminate information. Also with chambers of commerce and these industry associations that have presented to the reopening advisory board. And we will be able to disseminate information to you so that that can then be available to members and to inquiring businesses within your communities. There is also a question about the enforcement, because I did talk about this being a self-compliance issue, so that there is a checklist and a template. Business owners will be addressing the safety standards in these plans and have them available. The enforcement comes when there's a problem, right? There's someone that is experiencing a condition within the workplace as an employee, or someone coming to visit that place sees things not correct. They will call likely the Board of Health, and we, the at the state level through the Division of Labor Standards, can work in concert with the local Board of Health to determine if there is a non-compliance. So that we would want to organize to be able to do in conjunction with all of you. But there is not a need, because it would just be too cumbersome for local boards of health and inspection departments to go into a business and proactively check to see if they have a plan and also green light them locally. This has to be a self-compliance process in order for businesses to reopen with these safety standards. The other is regarding summer camps and municipal recreation. We've been working with Secretary Theo Harides on establishing a best practice guidance document for municipal recreation. In fact, one of your municipal rec counterparts from municipal government, she happens to be from Shrewsbury, Angela Snell, is on the work group analyzing the safe reopening of recreational facilities, playgrounds, et cetera. Summer camps, where we are working with the Department of Public Health in developing the guidance relative to summer camps, and we will be obviously sharing that with all of you when that is finalized.
There is so much there. I did notice also some questions about the timing of decisions on childcare as one of the enablers for a more robust reopening of the economy. I'm not sure if you're in a position to share the latest thinking regarding where that fits in on the phases, but that is something that obviously as municipal employers are concerned about as well regarding reopening of municipal operations and those that lack childcare.
Yeah, childcare is it's a really hard solve. We've had some time with the commissioner outlining what the challenges are and what the opportunities could be for this initial phase of reopening. We do have the emergency child care system that is not at full capacity in terms of the demand for those seats for children to be cared for. So we will continue to operate the emergency child care through this initial phase as we develop new models of child care as we open more places of work. That should also be in conjunction with remote work. Remote work for many employers is working for this time period, and we would encourage remote work when it makes sense. And of course, the childcare should be available for those employees that simply cannot work remotely and need childcare in order to get back to their job. Transportation also falls into a category of not easy to solve with these kinds of safety standards, but Secretary Pollack has established a roadmap for transitioning into this phase of reopening with limited capacity for transportation. We are running, in essence, a Saturday schedule on our MBTA and introducing other features for transportation as we roll out the reopening part of this process.
Oh, thank you. And then there are so many questions and so many issues that you continue to explore. I think we can continue back on this after we hear, make sure that we have a chance to get an update on CDBG, EDA funding and so on from Tim, and then take advantage of the other panelists in terms of answering questions as well. Does that sound okay, Lieutenant Governor?
Sounds great, yes.
Great. So, Tim, he's a Zoom expert. He knew how to show his video right away, and I'll spotlight you, and you can provide your update to us. Thanks for joining us.
No, thanks very much for having me, Jeff. And, the Lieutenant Governor asked that I join just to touch base on some of the economic development programs that we are following and trying to move forward. And so I'll only take 2 minutes out of the schedule to do that. First and foremost, we've been focused at the Executive Office of Housing and Economic Development about getting the Paycheck Protection Program from the SBA out in the environment, make sure banks are working closely with customers to get access. As we all know, it's been a challenge on that side in terms of the rollout and implementation of the program, but it has been ultimately successful. Over 50% of Massachusetts businesses have now received funding through the PPP. So we're seeing these programs go out and assist some of these businesses that have shut down. We recognize that has not been universal, and I know a question we've heard regularly is whether CDBG, Community Development Block Grant funding, would be available as well to augment what the PPP and some of the other SBA programs are doing and provide some local involvement in the process, the ability to help businesses on Main Street and the like. We have been waiting for direction from HUD on that funding. The CDBG funding was coming out in three phases, $2 billion nationwide. We, Massachusetts, were allocated a little over $20 million out of that pool. About $40 million went direct to entitlement communities. Those dollars were announced a few weeks ago. We have not received those dollars yet, although we were told this week that the HUD Boston office has those dollars now, so we will be able to start contracting soon. Phase two numbers were actually just announced. There's $1 billion nationwide for phase two. Massachusetts will receive $26 million. Those dollars will only go to the state. They will not go to entitlement communities. So those dollars, DHCD and the state will look to distribute across our communities. The first round will go just to non-entitlement communities from the state, since entitlement communities are getting their funding directly. The second round will go statewide. And then the third phase is $2 billion nationwide. We have not yet received an update on timing or funding amounts for that phase. So we are, in light of the fact that HUD Boston now has those funds, we are looking to put out a notice of funding availability, a NOFA. That should be coming out within the next week or so. There's two elements here. One is housing. Housing will not be distributed through the NOFA. DHCD is looking to work directly with housing providers that have worked on our RAFT program to provide support for homeowners and renters who need housing assistance. And those dollars will be augmented, not just the CDBG, but augmented by other funds in order to have about a $20 million pool to support households across the Commonwealth. The remaining $10 million from CDBG will be distributed, give or take, for public services and business assistance through that NOFA process. So non-entitlement communities will be able to apply, identify their local priorities and submit for funding to that, to those types of uses. Public services like food pantries or youth programs or senior programs, and then business support programs, similar to what entitlement communities have set up with their existing funding from CDBG. Again, we have not received the funds as yet. We have not gotten strict guidance, but we do know there is flexibility in the public services numbers. It can go over the 15% that is normally the restriction. So we anticipate those being fairly flexible funds for communities, although they are subject to the standard CDBG income requirements and the like. I do want to mention the EDA funds as well. EDA is being about $1.5 billion is being distributed nationally. Of that, $259 million is going to the Philadelphia office, which covers the New England area. We do want to encourage communities to look to EDA funding as well for the types of strategic or infrastructure needs that they might have. The funding can go towards planning and technical assistance, capital and recapitalization of revolving loan funds, construction of infrastructure or other economic development projects, and innovation grants. Those dollars are available now. They were released on May 7th. EDA started accepting applications on May 7th. The first 30 days, they're going to be working with existing partners who will receive funds. There's a commitment of funds to existing partners of EDA. But the open process, the competitive process will be up and available after the 30 days. Communities will start to get awarded on that broader competitive basis. So we encourage folks to work with the regional planning agencies. Those are often a first line of communication with EDA, or contact EDA directly. They encourage direct outreach and involvement from communities to understand the goals and to move those dollars, move those potential projects forward. Since the $259 million is available across the region, basically Philadelphia, New York, Massachusetts, and New England are all competing for the same pot of funds, we do want to encourage early application and kind of a drive to get those funds secured and in so that more come to the Commonwealth as possible.
Tim, there's an excellent suggestion that since there's so much here it would help to have as many communities really informed, a suggestion that it would even be possible to do an entirely separate Zoom meeting or briefing just on these programs and the steps to act. And if your office would be interested in doing that, we would definitely work with you to help produce and facilitate making something like that available.
We'd be happy to do it, definitely. And also, we have been updating the HED website. So mass.gov, go to the Executive Office of Housing and Economic Development. So for all the federal programs, we have been daily updating on what we're learning, how people apply. So you could use that as a resource to try to understand at least the broad brush of what these programs can do and how you might go about learning more.
You're an excellent mind reader, because as you were saying that, someone sent in the chat, is this information available online? And you were giving the website address at exactly when that came in. So thank you.
Sure.
So we'll work with you on producing something that provides more information, because we would like all of our members from Massachusetts to be first in line for any funding. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else to add? Okay, great. Lieutenant Governor, I'll turn it back to your team. I do know that there are some questions for some of the panelists as well. And I know Tim will stay, the Deputy Secretary, will stay on for the duration in case there are other questions that come in that regard.
Yes, I'd like to turn it over to, I believe it is, I'm not sure, maybe it's
Sean, I see a Carter question.
Let me just say one more thing on the state of emergency. There was a question, will the state of emergency continue? And the answer is yes, it will need to continue in order for certain orders that the governor issued to have effectiveness, as well as the issues regarding reimbursement from the federal government. We want to make sure that we are taking advantage of all opportunities there as well. So it will remain in place.
Thank you. And also I noticed that, and this had come up in another time this week with us, just an encouragement that the open meeting law relief be continued along that path until such time as it is safe actually for boards to meet. And so as the emergency continues, we hope the open meeting law order continues as well. I did see a question that perhaps Sam Phillips can answer before we dive over to others. And that was regarding how the provision of PPE to nursing homes and other senior care facilities, and if there are ways to that we can and communities can work with you to make sure that those facilities have what they need.
Sure. So nursing homes and other healthcare facilities can request personal protective equipment through their health and medical coalitions, and that goes to DPH. Although new late last week, there is starting to be a federal push of PPE direct to nursing facilities. So that's even going to continue to supplement the work that the Commonwealth is doing in providing PPE to critical health facilities.
Thank you. And do you have other updates for us or any further information, or would you just answer questions if they come up?
Well, I'll give just a quick update on PPE. So we've been doing a lot of work over the last couple of weeks to not only fulfill requests. So between MEMA and Department of Public Health, we've responded to well over, you know, between 5,000 and 6,000 requests for personal protective equipment. We also have been working on demand modeling to ensure we have adequate supply to continue to serve essential services, you know, through the duration of this and then, you know, well into the fall. On a parallel track, our colleagues at OSD have been working very closely on the contracting piece and making sure doing what they can to stabilize the supply chain. And they've already sent out some information to local procurement officers about how to leverage state contracts for PPE. So there'll be more information coming in the next couple of weeks, but we're encouraging local communities to start to explore PPE procurement now that we've seen some stabilizing of the supply chain.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Next, so that's very helpful. Thank you. Next, I'd ask Sean Cronin, because we're coming up with 10 minutes left, if you can jump in and give any brief updates that you would like to share from the Division of Local Services.
The only update that I have, Jeff, is that on Friday, we issued 3 bulletins that provide guidance associated with some of the relief measures provided in Chapter 53 of the Acts of 2020, dealing with the so-called 1/12 budget, which is really authority deficit spending 21, free cash use, and the 3-year amortization of any deficits fiscal 20. So those were posted Friday. Folks should have gotten an alert about it. If not, they're on our website. And that's really the only update I have right now.
Thank you. We had a couple of questions there. Do you have an update regarding the timing of information on the CARES Act?
Well, as you know, Jeff, you will be sending something out shortly after this meeting to invite folks on this call to have a discussion led by Secretary Heffernan and his team around that exact issue, CARES Act funding.
Thank you. I wanted to give the administration credit for actually setting up the meeting and asking us to host it. The MMA will be sending out, again, to everyone who's invited to this call, a briefing on the CARES Act, specifically from the administration, the Executive Office for Administration and Finance. And we thank the secretary and the entire team, certainly including you, Sean, for working hard to be able to provide information as soon as you can to communities regarding accessing CARES Act funds. So thank you very much for that. We do have a question regarding extension of earmarks. Communities did receive money in the budget this year. They have plans to move forward with those projects, but they can't implement because of the economic shutdown and restrictions on construction and so on. Is there any updates or consideration of having included in a package or some vehicle, the extension of those deadlines for action to be able to access the funds?
Yeah, I believe I mentioned, I don't know if it was this group or I know I spoke with STAM a week or so ago and this issue came up. ANF is working with each of the secretariats on a process to have municipalities basically ask for extensions. So the suggestion is to have communities reach out to the relevant agency, the agency that provided them the grant, whether it was an AMOC or not, and talk with that agency about getting an extension.
Okay, very good. And if there are some that would need additional authorization, those would be identified in the process, and perhaps strategies working with local legislators could be developed as well, and working with the administration. So thank you. We know that's very complicated, but in part, what you're doing is you're asking local officials to reach out to the agencies now and have those discussions to be able to get a sense of what needs to be done in order to have an extension.
Yes, and in some cases, the secretariats should be, or agencies should be able to, perhaps do a revised or amended contract. But in some cases, because of funding sources, they might not. So any feedback we can get would be very helpful in that.
Okay, thank you. And then looking ahead, we did have one question that came in regarding concern over in the long term that commercial properties, especially hotels and others, may seek to process a wave of abatement applications in 2021, given the change in the valuation of properties. Any strategies to address that issue that you've been thinking about regarding, for example, allowing assessors to assess at lower than 90% of market value just for 2021? And would mechanisms like that be an option in order to mitigate the a rush of abatement applications?
Yeah, that's a great question. Very big public policy or taxation policy issue. Remember one thing though, and we actually did something in our City and Town publication, I want to say last Thursday, where it was, written for assessors, it was like 8 or 10 tools assessors can utilize in times like this. And one of them spoke to this exact issue, which is you got to remember, and this will be confusing to some, especially taxpayers, that the valuations for the fiscal 21 tax bills are as of 1/1/20, meaning the calendar year 19 experience, which is obviously pre-COVID-19. So when tax bills go out, taxpayers like myself will see a value that we may or may not think is reflective of the current environment, but by statute, the valuation date is as of 1/1/20. So whether it's homeowners or business or property owners might have lots of questions about that because of the impact of COVID-19. They might file abatements, and then obviously it would be up to the ATB. The real issue was for fiscal 22, because that's when the impact on valuations will come into play, because that will be as of 1/1/21, meaning the calendar year 20 experience. And then maybe at that point, questions around 90% to 110% valuation range, can there be relief on that? I know I've had a conversation with a couple of communities about revisiting what was done back in 2004, I think it was, when communities had the ability to go up to 200% on the commercial industrial shift, the CIP shift, and then bring it back down to 175 over time. Those are things that my office is having conversations with the Assessors Association, their policy committee. Welcome any thoughts and suggestions people have, but I think while it might be confusing to many taxpayers, the real answer to the question is the values of your property are based on 1/1/20, meaning calendar 19 experience.
Boy, we got down in the weeds on that one. Thank you, Sean, very much. I appreciate that. Lieutenant Governor, we have 4 or 5 minutes left. Just wanted to turn it over to you for any further comments, or if you've been scrolling the chat, anything you wanted to add?
Yes, there are a lot of really good points here that are raised. So I'd like to just stress again that we have a municipal team that is formed as part of this reopening process that will need to work to address a number of issues that were raised today, as well as those raised in our prior call. And there may be others that come up to you, Jeff, in your team that we need to make sure that we are properly guiding you on what you need to do as you return more of your workforce back into city halls and town halls and DPW facilities, et cetera. And also help you be able to respond to any questions or complaints or concerns that are raised as activities begin to change in your community. So those two areas are really important, very complicated, and need to be done together. So we look forward to hearing from MMA tomorrow, the reopening board, around your presentation. But I just wanted you all to hear from me that there is a group that is working at the reopening board level with MMA and MAPC and others to help organize this effort. So if you can just continue to channel your questions to Jeff, not putting more on your plate, Jeff, but you can organize this with us so that we address these points in advance, at least try to, so that we're not surprised and don't see more things falling through the cracks when this phase opens.
And we appreciate that very much, Lieutenant Governor. Ordinarily, there are 10,000 touch points between local and state government, but it seems as though there are 100,000 questions regarding how to navigate, and new questions come up all the time. And we appreciate the dialogue and the opportunity to raise and problem solve these with you and with your team across and throughout the administration. I did want to, just to our membership who is participating in this briefing that you are putting on for our members, just note that the MMA's presentation to the Reopening Advisory Board will be posted shortly after our presentation. It will be focusing on timely notice, the request for specific, clear, and directive guidance in all of these areas, so everyone knows, the public and every actor, public and private, know what the responsibilities and steps are to ensure safety will be. That adequate resources from testing to PPE to finances and equipment be available, and that the enforcement coordination and collaboration be specifically worked in order to make sure that it's efficient and effective and provides communities with the tools and authority they need. And I think that's all pretty straightforward. And there are common themes for all communities, regardless of whether or not they're small or large, west or east. These are common challenges, and they're the same challenges the state is facing. So we look forward to sharing that, not only with you, Lieutenant Governor, but also with all of our membership in working on all of these particular questions. Just a reminder to everyone that we will take all of the unanswered questions, but I think most of them were addressed in this briefing, and forward them to the administration and then share back the answers to all of you. And then also, in addition to next week's, the administration's COVID-19 update for municipal CEOs, the MMA will be, has not yet, but will be shortly sending out the notice of the CARES Act briefing that will be happening this Thursday in the afternoon. We'll be pinning down that final details and getting that notice out to everyone right after this meeting this afternoon. So, Lieutenant Governor, any final comments before we adjourn for this week?
Hey, thank you very much. This was a full hour, a lot to it. Hang in there. And we'll continue to partner and work with all of you. Thank you very much for what you're doing.
Thank you. We thank you for your leadership, and we thank all of the local officials, the municipal leaders who are on this call, for your leadership and your making a difference, protecting your residents and building a stronger Commonwealth in the face of this threat. So We hope you have a good afternoon, and we look forward to continuing to work with you. Thank you.